This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Flood events are becoming more frequent and severe in West Virginia, causing millions of dollars in damage to property, disrupting communities, and displacing lives. But why?
That the ridge and valley topography kind of creates these really wide river valleys that provide a floodplain.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. A new analysis of special education data hopes to advance understanding and solutions for students with the greatest need. Chris Schultz has more.
Over the past 5 years, overall enrollment in West Virginia's public schools has declined by nearly 10%. However, educators like Rachel Brown say during the same period, the numbers of special education students have gone up.
Everyone's overworked as our numbers keep rising, and our county has done a lot of cuts this year because of our enrollment numbers have gone down, but we couldn't cut. Our numbers have gone up.
Brown is the IDAU, that's Intellectual Disabilities and Autism, Special Education Curriculum Specialist for Kanawha County Schools. She oversees more than 60 self-contained classrooms across the county where students with the most complex needs, who require the most support, are placed. The increase is not unique to Kanawha County, the state's largest school district.
Everywhere. It's increasing everywhere. I was discussing with a specialist yesterday, 10 years ago, she was in a rural part of the county, and I was like, I bet you had a sweet, tiny little classroom of like five. Now, in the same location, we have two self-contained classrooms at the school, and they're both full. That's a huge change, you know, over a decade.
A new analysis from the Institute for Policy Research and Public Affairs at West Virginia University's Rockefeller School of Policy and Politics is quantifying some of those changes. Samuel Workman is the director of the institute.
In West Virginia, it is a problem of some magnitude. We're talking between, depending on the year you look, anywhere from 40 to 50,000 students. So it constitutes about one in five in the current year. Of students. So 20% of our students, that's a great number of our young folks who are on independent educational plans.
He and his team analyzed the last 5 years of Individuals with Disabilities Education Act data, also known as IDEA, from the West Virginia Department of Education. The report compiled a data set from 2017 to 2023 addressing the demographics, geography, and trends in independent educational plans, or IEPs, in the state.
States will monitor things like how often these kids are in normal classrooms, or standard classrooms, I should say, any disciplinary actions taken against these children, and sort of assessing performance over time, both for their sake and relative to other students.
Workman's study shows the breadth of conditions, both physical and developmental, covered by IEPs. They run the gamut from difficulty with vision or hearing to psychological issues. The largest category is now specific learning disabilities, which Workman says the federal government defines as psychological problems with processing language. Categories like autism and developmental delay have also witnessed increases, especially in recent years.
Which I understand to be associated with a whole host of environmental problems in children, substance abuse in a home being one. But those are the sorts of things we are seeing, at least in present time, sort of explosion is probably too strong of a word, but certainly sharp upticks in the number of children categorized within those disability categories versus the traditional sort of hearing disabilities and this sort of stuff.
The analysis reveals interesting demographic distributions, including the fact that a near two-thirds majority of students on IEPs are male. More data and study is needed to better understand such discrepancies, as well as the relationship between the various factors driving the trends, including the opioid crisis and lack of access to resources like early childhood interventions. Workman credits the state's Department of Education for making the data easier to access. He hopes his study helps to make it easier to use and understand, and ultimately bring more eyes to the issue.
The way I organize data is not the way, say, a public health person would organize the data. It's not the way an education professional organizes data. And so continuing to work to make that data as integratable as possible with our public health systems and our education systems will work wonders in understanding the nature of the problem, what we're dealing with.
Workman says with one in five students having IEPs, the far-reaching effect of education from the immediate impact of each student to the broader implications for workforce development and businesses, makes a better understanding of special education needs imperative.
The degree to which we can better understand these children, help them to the extent possible to lead sort of productive, rich lives, both at home and at their place of work and all this sort of stuff, the better the off the state's going to be. It's a real problem with a real need for lots of eyes.
Brown agrees.
Numbers mean a lot and data means a lot. I always have hope. That's the best part of being a special educator. So yeah, I'm hoping that this will help make special education a priority and just education in general a priority in our state.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:49. Mostly sunny today, high temperatures in the 50s and 60s. Tonight, partly cloudy with lows in the 30s and 40s. Sunshine tomorrow with highs in the 60s and 70s. Support for WVPB is provided by Ziegler and Ziegler Attorneys in Hinton, marking 50 years of providing legal services for the people, businesses, nonprofits, and public agencies of West Virginia. Flood events are becoming more frequent and severe in West Virginia, causing millions of dollars in damage to property, disrupting communities, and displacing lives. Curtis Tate spoke with Nicholas Zegre, an associate professor of forest hydrology at West Virginia University, about what's behind this trend.
What makes West Virginia and Appalachia so vulnerable to severe, frequent floods?
When we think about floods, in particular in West Virginia, we have to think about them as two ways. One is what we call a riverine-based flood. So the larger rivers that flood when they spill over the stream, the riverbanks onto the floodplain, which of course are normally dry areas. And so when we look at flooding in West Virginia, we see that riverine flooding, there are hot spots in the eastern panhandle where we see a lot of that riverine flooding. And that's associated with like the Ridge and Valley, like, you know, the large rivers like the Potomac, that the Ridge and Valley topography kind of creates these really wide river valleys that provide a floodplain. And we certainly have that in other parts of the state. But when we think about like hot spots in the state, the eastern panhandle, the riverine flooding is a big problem.
Okay.
But the other type of flooding we're concerned about in West Virginia is flash flooding. And flash flooding can happen anywhere. It can happen certainly in our small streams and our heavily dissected, headwater valleys where 85% of our streams in West Virginia are small streams. And of course, we know we have people living up and down just about every hollow in West Virginia. And so in perspective, we actually have two hotspots. We have a hotspot in the West Fork watershed, kind of in that Clarksburg, Bridgeport, Harrison County area. And then we also see a flash flooding hotspot kind of central to Kanawha and, what we refer to as kind of those southern coalfield counties. Now, that said, flash flooding and riverine flooding does happen everywhere throughout the state. But if we're thinking about, you know, a higher propensity for flash flooding or for riverine flooding, we do see these emerging trends on where there's a greater probability of them happening.
So, for example, in the 2016 flood disaster in southern West Virginia, was it more the second type?
When they started collecting stories of what the flood looked like, the 2016 flood looked like, and when from the community and the first responder perspectives, and then when we started looking at what the floods looked like from a hydrology perspective, what became clear was it was a different type of flood in different parts of the Greenbrier watershed. So around Richwood and Raynell, for example, that was more flash flood. a wall of water moving very, very quickly downslope. Whereas when you're in the White Sulphur Springs and kind of Lewisburg area, it was more of a riverine flood where the water, the river level rose and kind of spilled over and filled the wider valley. And what's interesting, Curtis, is when you start thinking about where the damage was and vulnerability and also recovery, we saw very different damage and very different approaches to response and recovery in Raynell versus like White Sulphur Springs. And, you know, we can tie that back to the different types of floods. But I should say that in the case of the 2016 flood, there were a lot of flash floods that routed downstream that also contributed to the larger riverine flood. And so we could have multiple types of floods occurring in the same event, which is going to be related to the topography and the stream channel and what all that looks like.
What's driving the heavier rainfall?
Heavier rainfalls are the result of a warmer atmosphere. You know, we think of the atmosphere as like a balloon. And if you blow up the balloon in your house in January and it's warm inside your house, you know, the balloon is expanded. And if you walk outside in that cold winter day, that balloon is going to contract. I walk back inside to that warm house and the balloon's going to expand. So that's what's happening with warming temperatures in the atmosphere. With a warmer temperature, the atmosphere expands, which means it can store more water. But with warmer temperatures, there's more evaporation of water from our soils and our trees and our rivers and our lakes. And so more water is being put into the atmosphere and more of that water can be stored in the atmosphere. And once the atmosphere reaches saturation, we have these very heavy, intense rainfalls. And so heavy rainfall and air temperature is very clearly related. In fact, for a single 1 degree temperature increase in 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in air temperature, the atmosphere can hold 4% more water. And so as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water and it creates more rainfall.
How much does land use, whether commercial, residential, or industrial, contribute to the problem?
Whether it is, what we would call an old growth forest or a Walmart parking lot, if you drop 8 to 10 inches of rain in a couple of hours, like what was experienced in eastern Kentucky two summers ago, there's going to be flooding. Our systems just aren't designed to handle that much water. But land use activities very much affect how quickly water runs off. And so impervious surfaces associated with industrialization, associated with urbanization, and associated with, the result of surface mining. All of this routes water more quickly. More water is routed more quickly off that landscape. And so when we think about, you know, how do we mitigate these effects of extreme rainfall and flooding? Putting our landscape back into forests is a really important part of this conversation. But land use is a really important driver of flooding. But I should also say that it's really hard to detect the effects of like a single neighborhood or a single mine or a single, you know, clear cut parcel and the effect that has on flooding. And so we often think about this, we know how water cycles through the atmosphere and through the earth. And so what happens when you remove forests and remove soils, that water can't be stored and that water is not removed from runoff. So all of that goes downstream.
That was Nicholas Zegray of the WVU Mountain Hydrology Laboratory speaking with Curtis Tate about flooding in West Virginia. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Randy Yowie. Eric Douglas is our news director, and he produced today's show. I'm your host, Teresa Wills. This is West Virginia Morning.